Every year when Jennifer and I directed summer camps for third and fourth grade boys and girls, in the first couple of days, no matter what the composition of the group was, we knew that there was going to be a hunger strike. There was always one or two campers who had a case of homesickness, and the symptom of that was, I ain't eating nothing. Usually that passes within a day or so. Sometimes, though, you had a more complicated case, and the child was a picky eater in general. And so we've had campers who wouldn't eat anything that was the color green, so that takes out all vegetables and salad and things like that, or anything that didn't come out of a box or a can, or anything that their father's hands had not made himself, which makes it awful difficult at summer camp to say, I'm sure your father touched this somehow or made this somehow. And we've had children, and it seems like this happened more than once. Several of these children tried to make it through, for whatever reason, and I'm not quite sure why, they tried to make it through a whole week because of their hunger strike and their homesickness issues and their picky eating on nothing but, and this grosses me out, nothing but croutons and ranch dressing. I don't know how you do that. That's disgusting. But let me tell you that empty bellies or bellies that have only been fortified on croutons and ranch dressing are not optimal for 1 week in summer camp in 80 degree weather, playing kickball or creek walking or going out swimming. Yet the question of filling up our stomachs is an appropriate question for us on World Communion Sunday, not least because we live in a world where issues of hunger are something that we come face to face with every day in this world. It's appropriate in our land where many children go to bed hungry because their families live in poverty. It's appropriate in our world with grinding poverty and famine in some war-torn countries worldwide. And the question that Exodus itself deals with is God fills not only the stomachs of the Israelites. Remember the miracle, they're starving, and there's the miracle of the quail and the manna that God sends, the bread that God sends from heaven. The Israelites have to learn that they will be fed by leaning on God and trusting God, and that God will provide. Yet the rest of the book of Exodus is not just about God providing a meal. In the 11 months that the Israelites camped around Mount Sinai, waiting for the Ten Commandments and waiting for more instruction, God provides the Israelites not only with food for their stomachs, but also food for their souls. Exodus chapter 19 to the end of the book is a menu of sorts. And you are invited to pick off the menu things that will nourish your body, but also things that will nourish your soul. God speaks to the Israelites through Moses by saying, I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now obey my voice and keep my covenant. God says, if you do what happens from chapter 19 on, then we will be in relationship the same way an eagle is in relationship to her eaglets. It's a powerful image. God as a mother eagle teaching her eaglets to fly. It also shows up again in Deuteronomy chapter 32. Eagles have huge wingspans, and a mother eagle is known to cover her young in the nest. Eagles, from the time they hatch until the time they learn themselves how to fly, it's about 10 to 12 weeks. And they need that protection because there are other predators that might try and snatch an eaglet out of the nest. They need that protection because of rain or because of sun. Biologists have seen mother eagles with their huge wingspan shading the chicks on hot, sunny days. And God says, you eaglets, you Israelites, there are two things you have to do here. You have to keep my covenant and obey my voice. Covenant, we talked about a few weeks ago. Covenant is a word that means a special relationship or promise between God and his people. The very first covenant in the Bible is the covenant of the rainbow after the flood, where God promises not to flood the earth again. Then in Genesis chapter 12, God makes a promise to Abraham that he will enter into the promised land and that through Abraham's descendants, all of the world will know of God's blessing. That's in Genesis 12, and then gets worked out a little bit more in Genesis 15 and 17. This same covenant gets a little bit fuller expression when God gives the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. And we are to follow them. We are to fill our souls with observing the Sabbath, or honoring our father and mother, or refraining from killing and adultery. That's the covenant piece of it. But that's not all that God says here. God says, you are to keep my covenant, but God also says you are to obey my voice. From Exodus 20 to the end of the book, or better, to the end of the Bible, or even better, to the end of history, God expands on the Ten Commandments. God doesn't stop speaking on Sinai and say, you know what, I'm finished. The rules are all laid out for you. Go and see how it works out. God doesn't stop speaking in the Bible. God doesn't stop speaking in history. God keeps on speaking to you and to me. That's why in the church we say that when someone is ordained into ministry, they experience a call. They are called into ministry. That person has to have a sense that God is calling to them, God is speaking to them, and that they are invited by God to work in ministry. And the pastor of Emmanuel Church does not have a contract. It's not a contract. It's called a call. And the reason it's called a call is because the congregation believes that God has called them, that God has spoken to them, that this person is the person who is called to lead them at this moment. And the pastor believes the same thing, that this is the location where I am called to do ministry, that God has spoken to me, and that God says this is the place where we are to work together to do ministry. It's called a call agreement, not a contract, not a work agreement or anything like that. That's why it's called a call. God extends the Ten Commandments throughout the Bible and throughout history. Not long after the Ten Commandments, God gives instructions for the Israelites to build the Ark of the Covenant. God gives the idea of how to care for the poor in Isaiah, like we heard in the children's message. Jesus speaks God's commands in the Sermon on the Mount, doing a very similar thing to what Moses does. Jesus goes up onto the mountain and speaks to the Israelites. God speaks through Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. God speaks, we believe, through Jesus' words. Jesus says further on in Mark and Matthew, you are to love your neighbor as yourself. God speaks through Jesus when Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, you are to love your enemies. You are to bless those who curse you. Do good to those that hate you. Matthew chapter 5, verse 44. And if we're honest, we're not doing so well on listening to God speak about any of these issues right now. I wrote this sermon earlier in the week, not knowing what was going to happen politically in this country, and I've noticed that I thought, you know, how am I going to say, you know, if things go one way or things go the other way, how can I preach a gospel that's the same no matter how this turns out? It was quite a challenge. Maybe I should get a bonus this week for trying to figure out how to do this, how to split the difference. I'm joking, of course. Instead of emulating Jesus, Jesus brought together in his 12 disciples the right wing and the left wing. Did you know this? That Jesus brought Matthew, the tax collector, who worked for the Romans, and Simon the zealot, who believed that the Romans were illegitimate and wanted to overthrow the government. Jesus brought those two together into the 12. And there were probably other shades and differences of political opinion in Jesus' 12 disciples. And instead of doing that, we have done something quite different. We have become quite polarized. I realized when I was doing this sermon that no matter what happened on Capitol Hill this week, somebody was going to be mad. Somebody was going to be in the position of Matthew the tax collector or Simon the zealot. Somebody was going to be mad. Somebody was going to be disappointed. And it did not appear to me that there was an easy way to resolve this, no matter what happened. Yet I went back to the Sermon on the Mount, and Jesus does not say, love only those senators who. Jesus does not say, love only those nominees who. Jesus does not say, love only those witnesses who. God speaks to us forcefully from Sinai, from the mountaintop, to be better than this. God calls you to reconcile, not with Republicans if you're a Republican, or Democrats if you're a Democrat. That's easy. Jesus says, it's easy to be friends with people who agree with you. That's not hard. Anybody can do that. God commands you and me to listen and to pray, because this reconciliation is not going to happen in the halls of power. Reconciliation will happen if we Christians decide to get our act together and show the world a better way. That Christians can have and host conversations where we love those who live differently, where we bless those who disagree with us, where we, Jesus says in Matthew 5, in the Sermon on the Mount, bless those who do evil to you. That's a tall order, but it's a Christian order. But because of sin and our human nature, it's much easier to say, oh, the other side's wrong, forget them, they'll never learn. But Jesus doesn't say that. God's voice, which rings throughout Matthew 5, but also Exodus 19 and 20, God's voice is not about incivility and disrespect, where one side has to win and the other side must lose. At bottom, your worst political enemy, I want you to think who your worst political enemy is, the person who's most ideologically on the opposite from you. At bottom, your worst political enemy still gets sick, gets widowed, declares bankruptcy, has to go to the ER, falls down and breaks an ankle. It happens at the same rate to everybody, no matter what your political kin, no matter what your political label is. And at bottom, if those things happen, if people get widowed, get sick, declare bankruptcy, go to the emergency room, break hips, break ankles, it's our job to minister to them. I've never gone into the emergency room and said, you know what, before I pray with you, I got to know, where's your voter registration card? I've got to know what you think about what's going on in the world today. It's never happened. And I hope it never does. Well, it's October 1st. Summer camp season is over. Croutons and ranch dressing, that diet is finished. Thank goodness for me. If you're like me, your summer diet sort of finished too. There's no more getting that extra hot dog from the grill or that soda pop from the cooler. Or those Kennywood potato patch fries. That's over, right? Because we're moving into a new season. It's time to fill our bellies with healthier food, hopefully. In a similar fashion, God says the same thing to us in Exodus 19 and 20. God says the same thing to us in your life and in my life. God says, fill your souls. Not with the junk food of anger and bitterness, indifference or mocking, but fill your souls with the Sabbath. Fill your souls with love, with honor of parents, with truthfulness and honesty, with refraining from coveting, with refraining from killing, with respect, with reverence, with prayer. Fill your souls with healthy food. Healthy food, spiritual food, which God provides in abundance. Amen.